You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Elena Santigade. My guests today are Hadley and David Kreitz, co-founders of Daily Driver, the first ever urban creamery in San Francisco. In addition to being a creamery, Daily Driver is a cafe that also features wood-fired bagels and local coffee roaster Red Bay Coffee. Hadley has been the head cheesemaker at Tamales Farmstead Creamery for the past 5 years, and David both designed Daily Driver itself and developed the bagel recipe. For this new endeavor, they've partnered with the owners of Tamales Farmstead Creamery and Tuluma Farms, Tamara Hicks and David Jablons. Hadley and David, welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you so much for
having us. Thanks for having us.
So, first of all, you've just landed from San Francisco. And I'm very excited that you're here in studio in person with me, because this is a real treat to talk to a San Francisco-based business, but here. So thanks for trekking out to Brooklyn.
We're so excited to be here.
So let's get to the sort of like big questions first. Why open an urban creamery? I'm sure I'm not the first one to ask. Why go through the trouble? Why the hassle of making in the city? Tell me a little bit about that thinking.
Firstly, we like the idea of food transparency. We like the idea of people being able to see where their food comes from. A lot of the kind of mantra behind Tuluma Farms and Tamales Farmstead Creamery is education. And Tamara and David have worked really hard to make sure that people come out to the farm and see where milk, how milk is made. And that it's from female goats. Believe it or not, I've had to answer that question many times. And then how the cheese is actually made. So I think that's part of it.
Also, it's never happened before, which is really exciting for people to experience what's happening with food right now. I mean, everybody wants to get involved and be immersive and understand where their food's coming from. So why not bring it directly to the source?
Right. You're pioneers in that sense out there on the West Coast. We have some urban creameries scattered throughout the country. There's one here in New York. Beecher's does cheesemaking right in the middle of Manhattan, which is an endeavor that I'm hoping you get to visit while you're here.
Yes, definitely.
But tell me a little bit about the products that you're making.
We're making a cultured butter. So I've always loved butter. I come from more of a farming background than a cheesemaking background. So butter to me is something where you can see kind of like what the cows are eating and what season it is and how the farm practices are occurring just based on one, almost like a terroir of with wine. It's very similar to
and
that.
And you feel like you can get to that through butter more directly.
Oh, absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, even our butter comes from Jersey cows exclusively. So the color is very intense. I mean, when the pastures are vibrant, so was our butter. When our pastures are brittle, so was our butter. So it's something that I love to like equate and kind of see happening in the creamery in that regard.
Yeah, you can point to that really easily, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We also do Kork, which is a German cheese, but it kind of has that Greek yogurt slash cottage cheese mouthfeel combined. It's this beautiful cheese. It's all it is milk and cultures. There's nothing else to it.
Amazing.
So again, it's very pure.
Is Kork, sometimes I think of it like fresh chev, but usually made with cow's milk. And You're saying there's a little more texture to it.
A little bit. It's funny. If you Google Kork, it comes up with every type of texture. I mean, anything from a feta crumbly down to something that's like a whipped perfect yogurt.
Right.
So in the beginning, I was actually whipping the cork because I felt like I wasn't getting the right look of it.
Right.
But in reality, it's actually, you want some of that texture to it, which is really great. And it's literally just milk and cultures. There's nothing else to it. So the milk does all the work, which is, I find, really beautiful.
Right.
We also do a cream cheese, of course, because it's a bagel.
Yes, good. I'm happy you have that.
Bagel bakery. That's like the impetus of having the creamery there, of course. And our cream cheese has been interesting. We've had to kind of educate our customers that cream cheese is something that's not necessarily flexible like a Philadelphia. It's something that's actually really beautiful and tangy and a little bit whipped and has maybe a little bit of a different mouthfeel than you're used to.
So would you say your cream cheese is a bit lighter?
It is lighter.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. We have to add just a teeny tiny bit of cream. But other than that, it's just, again, it's very similar to just the milk doing the work, which is great. Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the bagels.
The bagels,
yeah. To the bagels.
And what flavored bagels do you have?
All of our bagels, we've added a couple recently, so previously, all of our bagels were pretty standard, plain bagel with whatever seeds happen on top
classic
of them. So
we
were hitting
topping.
The classics, right? The everything, the garlic, the salt.
Onion? I'm an onion bagel fan.
Absolutely.
Okay,
the
good.
Onion, the poppy,
great.
The sesame. Yeah. Recently, we've added, we took on a baker. It's this amazing guy, Rene. He's an Austrian baker who brought a potato bagel on.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is unbelievable. He just came out with a rye, which is using a pumpernickel flour.
Yeah.
And then also a cinnamon raisin.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think we're at 9 right now.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So this all comes together in the cafe. And tell me a little bit about, I'm curious how often people are trying all of these things in their bagels or how much people are doing just sort of like standard cream cheese. Like, have you had a big learning challenge with quark in getting people to think of that as a bagel topping, or what's that been like?
Yeah, we actually do something like a quark cup. So something that's like maybe an alternative to a gluten extra product like a bagel.
Got
so,
it.
With
a little topping.
We make
in-house
jams
or
treat it kind of like a parfait, which is really
love
nice.
That.
So it's, but we have, I mean, you've taken samples before of the quark and cream cheese and bagels and people put both on and don't kind of realize that it's not necessarily a standard bagel topping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cream cheese being such a kind of original sort of cream cheese has gotten people interested in what else can I put on the bagel, especially in this particular instance. So the quark, the ghee has been a bagel topping, obviously the butter, and we've just gotten into mixing things up with the cream cheese and starting to go to that place, the veggie and the jalapeno and
nice.
All those different places, which is a lot of fun.
Getting wild.
Yeah, getting wild, exactly. Yeah.
And David, do you have a bagel background?
I have zero bagel background.
So did you have bagel dreams? How did this come to be that you're the bagel guy?
I had a bagel request from David Jablons and Tamara Hicks, obviously the farm owners. Mm-hmm. And David is an Italian Jew from right here in New York City.
Nice.
Born and bred. And so when the cream cheese came about at the creamery up north in Marin, I had built them a wood-fired oven on their farm there, and I was making pizzas, not too dissimilar from here. And I let it slip that I could make bagels, because how hard could it be? And then I went into the prototyping phase, and, you know, a few months later had something I thought was really good.
Wow.
And, yeah, so we tested it around the people that we trusted, their palates, and, it's been just crazy ever since then. Yeah.
So when did you open Daily Driver?
Middle of June.
Yeah, the middle of
middle
June.
Middle of June.
It's like a bit of a blur. Yeah.
A few months.
Yeah.
But I'm very impressed that you're already taking a little break.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
For us, we've been working on it like any restaurant for 2.5+
right.
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
So it feels like it's about time
yeah.
for us.
Yeah.
But
yes.
it's also exactly.
Well, it's the mark of a good opening that you can, that's actually almost like a finish line of sorts
totally.
In a big way, that then you have some space to breathe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how big is your staff?
We have 23 employees right now.
Okay, wow. Mm-hmm. That's pretty sizable.
And all of us founders, the four partners, are all involved in the business, so we're all actually working there also.
So you know, Hadley, you, I mentioned at the top of the show that you were involved, you were the head cheesemaker up in Marin.
Yeah.
At Tamales Farmstead Creamery. Are you still making cheese there also?
Or no.
What is, yeah.
So okay. I started as an apprentice there.
Okay.
Long ago.
And that was your first cheese making?
It was my first cheese making, not my first dairy endeavor.
Okay.
The first cheese making endeavor. Mm-hmm. I actually met Tamara, who's the owner of the farm, and David and I went on a Tinder date on the same day. So it was felt like moons were aligned.
Wow, that's a big day.
It was a big day.
That's incredible. Very efficient.
Yes. But so I was actually an apprentice, a farm apprentice there. And then I kind of moved, wore many hats, was a farm manager there for a little while, and then started making cheese and loved the cheese making part of it.
Mm. What did you love about it?
I loved kind of the routine of everything. The routine, but the non-routine. The milk was always changing constantly. Right. So it was always problem solving. But the idea of making the same cheese on the same day and striving for that kind of same quality every time.
Mm-hmm.
I also loved seeing how the milk changed with the seasons, kind of what I was talking about before.
With the butter.
Like something that's super fascinating to me.
Yeah.
With goat and sheep milk, which is what we were working with at Tamales Farmstead Creamery, a little bit less obvious than it was with the
Jersey.
Yellow Jersey milk, which was still kind of fun. It's like a treasure hunt, figuring out the different pieces of what has changed with the proteins and the sugars and the this and that.
So. How long would you say it took you to have kind of like a feeling for that, to really be able to identify those changes?
Still working on it.
Yeah.
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 Every season is completely different. Mm. I think I know, since Tamales Farmstead Creamery is a farmstead creamery, I actually had like kind of a cheat sheet from the farmer, so I knew what was happening.
Right, insider info.
Yeah, so then I was able to kind of like equate things that were happening in the creamery.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So then now you're solely based in the city.
We are in the city,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
And this whole time leading up to Daily Driver, had you been commuting from the city to Marin, to the farm, or were you living more of a rural existence?
We were living rurally.
Okay.
Yeah, we were up in Tamales.
Mm-hmm.
We had a small little water tower that we lived in, and I was driving to San Francisco on the daily to, you know, do everything with the general contractors and meet with architects and whatnot.
Got it.
During the building phase, yeah. So a year and a half or so of that.
Wow. And what about now? Where do you live?
We moved.
Okay.
So pre-opening, we moved to Piedmont, which is where I was before all the magic happened. As we alluded to with a Tinder date.
And sorry, I had to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love
funny.
It. And, I totally love it.
Yeah, so we moved back there with our daughters and, you know, got reintegrated. And while we were starting this business, figured out where the schools were going to be, you know, all that stuff that you
have to do.
Wow,
so this is a big shift.
Big shift.
It is a big shift, yeah.
How has it been uprooting, you're not only opening a whole new business, but totally changing the landscape of your lives with two little kids. Did you say two kids?
A three-year-old and a two-year-old. Yeah. Yeah.
So was that part of it, the move into a more urban space? Was that part of the draw in terms of starting this new business? Or how did you feel about that, like, initially?
I don't know that we knew what we were going to do once it opened. I think we just kind of thought, here's this challenge, and we're going to just kind of roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the most sense for us to go back to the city to be able to be there. And I think we realized, like, the importance of us being there all the time versus, you know, spending that much time on the road. Yeah.
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 But it's been amazing. I mean, so exciting. It's been so exciting the whole time.
Yeah.
It's different all the time, and we're always having to problem solve and figure out how to make it work. And to this day, we're still, you know, who's going to babysit and how am I going to get there? And, you know.
So would you say that it has more in common with your rural living than you expected, or more different?
I mean, we were living, to give you an idea, in a 300-square-foot water tower that was basically like a lighthouse on Route 1, which is amazing and beautiful and
sounds
bucolic.
Sounds sort of incredible
and,
in its own way, but 300 square feet with four people.
It's 100 square feet stacked on top of each other, too. It's a very strange setup.
Wow.
But we had, again, two teeny children and a large sheepdog, and... It felt
and
great
160
at the time.
Acres of farm to go to. So
the farm was right there to go to, which was wonderful.
So you mostly lived outside, I take it.
Exactly.
A lot of the time.
Yeah. But so it feels good to be in the city. It just feels different. It feels like now we all live in one level and we can walk places. And
all right.
Yeah. And I'm kind of, I used to live in New York, so I feel like I'm getting reacclimated to living in a city again, which feels
you know what it
normal.
Feels like.
Yeah, it feels good. Feels good.
Totally. Do you have any more square feet?
A teeny bit.
Yeah, we do. Oh, man. I know how that is.
Yeah.
So you're doing this whole endeavor. You're not really sure that you're even going to end up moving your family full time. What would you say has been the most surprising thing that's happened since you opened?
For me, I think kind of the innovative spirit of the employees that have come on that we work with, whether it's in the catering and events realm, whether it's in the kitchen, whether it's in the baking, people have brought all of kind of their expertise and have kind of shined a light on the things that we already knew we were going to do and improved on them, which has been really great. I mean, we kind of had an idea what our menu was going to be going in and how we were going to produce things. And then once everyone got together and collaborated, it became kind of this other sort of fluid object that was kind of blurbing its way through space. And it's constantly changing and constantly interesting. That I didn't expect. So
that's a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was a surprise that the creamery aspect worked. That we could bring like milk into the city.
Yes.
And everything that I had been kind of envisioning in terms of function and systems and relaying to David and to contractors and trying to get things work actually worked. I think the first time we put milk into the vat that came from the udder that I picked up the other day, I was like, wow, this is shocking.
And surprisingly faster than the other sort of disciplines that we were doing. I mean, I definitely thought that was going to take the longest time to get through health, to get through California Department of Agriculture, whatnot. But it was done first. It passed 100%, like no problem. And I and maybe part of it's just kind of like that we've never seen this before. We're going to throw our hands up sort of situation.
Right, so you guys can kind of define the terms in a nice way.
It's been a really, it's been a really interesting journey that way. I mean, even from the like being able to move certain dairy products through vehicles from one place to another, there had been no precedence for. So, you know, everybody's kind of looking at their rule book and they don't really know what to say. So we're, you know, breaking some
ground
there.
You're sort of the beta.
Yeah, exactly. It's really fun that way. Yeah.
Wow, that's exciting. I have so many follow-up questions, but we're going to pause and jump to a quick break, and listeners, we'll be right back to talk more about bringing milk to the city and everything that ensues.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm the host of What Doesn't Kill You here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with journalists, authors, scientists, or activists to identify and explain some of the key issues in our food system. I've done shows on food waste, labor issues, meat production, water, you name it, I cover it. You can find What Doesn't Kill You wherever you listen to podcasts, and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm Elena Santigade, and I'm here with Hadley and David Kreitz of Daily Driver in San Francisco. Okay, so there were a bunch of things that you each mentioned right before the break that I want to talk more about. First on the list is, how do you get milk to the creamery. So you're bringing milk from Marin, from Tamales Farmstead, or
Silva Family Dairy.
Oh, okay. Say it again. Sorry.
Silva Family Dairy.
Oh, okay.
So they're actually sixth and seventh generation dairy farmers in Tamales.
Got it.
They're Jersey cow
dairy. And so did you know them when you were making cheese out there?
Yeah. So one of the cheeses that we make at Tamales Farmstead Creamery, uses their milk. We make something called Talika. That's a cow, goat, and sheep, almost like a Latour. And that's where the cow comes from. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So that's where you're getting your milk. How far is it traveling to get into your location in San Francisco?
It's traveling about 70 miles.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's coming. It was, I went through all different kind of systems of how it would get there. Hmm. We landed on using what's basically like a 300-gallon tote, like an industrial tote to move liquid.
Wow.
Yeah, it's with a bladder and a hose and a motor and the whole thing. And we have a refrigerated truck. So once a week, I go up to the farm. I talk to the farmer. They're good friends of mine. And I take half of the milk over to Tamales Farmstead Creamery, which is about a 3-mile drive.
Okay.
Actually, I take it all there. I use half in the creamery to separate it into cream for the butter.
Ah, so you're doing your first step out there.
First step. Pasteurize and separate.
Which makes sense, because it wouldn't make so much sense to truck all of that milk into the city and then only use part of it, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So half of it gets separated there. Half of it goes down to the city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And so then when you're bringing it into the city, how do you get the timing right? Like, how important is it that you do your sort of milk transfer at a certain time of day?
Oh, yeah.
What is traffic? Is it like a nightmare? When do you do it? Are you doing it in the middle of the night?
Yeah. That would make a lot more sense,
well,
I think, actually.
In some ways, but also not in other ways.
We pick up after milking is complete on Tuesdays, which is usually around 9 a.m. So I wait for the farmers to finish, pick up all the milk. They take, we've got an amazing delivery driver named Alex. Hey, Alex.
Yay. Delivery drivers
he's
are so
listening
important.
To this. Yeah. So he's awesome. He drives it in this like short little refrigerated truck down to the city, and he has it there for us when we get there Wednesday morning. So Wednesday morning we pasteurize right away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're pasteurizing also on site.
Yes. We pasteurize on site.
And was that tricky as you were trying to set up the equipment and the regulations? Like, did you have to, was that one of these, like, everybody's sort of saying, sure, pasteurize, you know, like how tricky was it to set that system up in the city?
It was, yeah, it was tricky. I mean, there's a, you know, there's the obvious steps that the milk has to go through before we can get it to the product. Mm-hmm. So it was always a question of like, how much are we going to do up north? How much are we going to bring down here? Mm-hmm. And eventually settled on having a vat pasteurizer in the space, which is a large enough piece of equipment to where it would have to go in before the walls were built. So it was kind of like
that was an
making
early
decisions
decision.
In sort of a layered sort of way to where it's going to land. Mm-hmm. Maybe at the point where we had to like suspend it from the ceiling to finish the floors out and everything to pass code. But yeah, it was a difficult process.
And can your customers see the vat? They do have a way to.
So the creamery, I mean, it's everything. Much like this, where it's just all one window.
Right.
And it's actually a marble slab where I paddle all of the butter, and I share that marble slab with the customer. So they can actually, when they're having their coffee, feel me kind of paddle all of the butter, which is super cool.
So the slab, it's sort of like an indoor-outdoor pool.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. In the hotels
with
of my youth.
In between. Yeah.
With major sanitation.
Yes.
All right. Very cool. Okay. This is amazing. And so it's been working. You have once a week you're doing this?
We're bringing milk in once a week. Mm-hmm. Yep. We pick milk up twice a week. Part of that gets separated up north. And then I culture. So we pasteurize. We separate the milk. And then we culture the milk and let it ferment for about 2 days. Mm-hmm. And then I let it hard cure for another 2 weeks before I actually churn it. So it'll come down to the space after it's done fermenting, and I do the rest of the curing kind of on the spot in
the shop.
So
the butter is sort of held, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've never actually asked this about butter, but do you refer to it as like aging? It seems like no, you're not aging butter, but you're holding it.
Exactly. We kind of say curing. I don't know if that's like the correct technical term, but well, it does
if
ferment.
You say it, I'm considering it correct. You're the one, you make the butter. So to me, you're the expert.
Okay. Then in that case, I ferment it for about 2 days. So that's out in not heat necessarily, but in kind of like a 60 to 70 degree
a warmer
temperature
condition. Okay.
And then when it goes into the walk-in, it basically, it doesn't stop the fermenting process, but it slows it way down.
Right.
And then I let it kind of get to the acidity that I want it to be, which takes another 2 weeks.
About. Got it. And so you're culturing that. And so it's, mm-hmm. it's developing that cultured butter flavor.
Yes.
And do you salt it?
I do. I salt it in the churn. I've got a European style churn. It's basically an auger in a big metal box.
Mm-hmm.
Very technical term there, mm-hmm. big metal box. But I churn it in there and then I clean it in there. So I use ice water and all that. And then I salt it with Himalayan salt.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I was a part of a butter sort of production, like R&D process, and salt was the trickiest thing mm-hmm. because if your salt crystals are too fine, they disappear.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And plus salt is pulling out the moisture in a way. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So how much have you played around with that? How have you navigated? Did it take a while to land on the salt that you use?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A lot. For the 2 years while we were under construction, I had two tiny kids with me, so I was just at home. I wasn't working at Tamales mm-hmm. Farmstead Creamery. I was actually at home, like, doing R&D constantly in a little KitchenAid with milk from here, different types of salt, different types of cultures, and trying to land on the exact taste I was going for.
That's kind of amazing that you did your R&D while you're taking care of two tiny babies.
So
doing your
fun.
Own R&D. Yeah. I won't get like too graphic, but I imagine maybe there's also some cheese making going on there for the kids.
Yes.
Anyway, but it's so cool that you were able to do that R&D at home, you know, in that smaller space.
Yeah.
It makes a ton of sense.
Yes. I think in retrospect, it seems very cool and sweet.
And
I think
also
at the time it was difficult.
Efficient. Yeah. I'm sure at the time it was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's now I feel like I understand cream to a max, which as a cheesemaker before, I was working with goat milk primarily.
Mm.
Cream wasn't something that I necessarily knew a lot about.
Right.
I came from Vermont before here, and we always made raw
mm-hmm.
butter
mm-hmm.
and it didn't need anything. It just,
right. It just did all
good.
The magic on its own.
Yeah. So I was trying to recreate that, making raw butter in my friend's kitchen and trying to recreate that taste and the texture and everything. And it's again, something that's like ever changing. So you're always trying to catch up with it and make it the right.
And would you say that was your inspiration, that like Vermont butter you're referring to?
Yeah. Grandmother grew up on a dairy farm in West Virginia, and that's like always been something close to my heart. A Jersey dairy farm. She always talked about their eyelashes, which I
think they're so precious, right?
Yeah. But it wasn't until after I lived in New York and then moved to Vermont that I started really coming into contact with dairy as a whole, but really focusing on butter.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, wow, this is just making my mouth water, I have to say. And you're also making ghee, which we didn't talk about too much, but listeners, I am sitting here with ghee in front of me, which I'm very excited about because it's one of my favorite products. Why ghee?
Yeah. I was just making a ton during the R&D time, and I didn't want the butter to go bad. So I was trying to figure out a way where I could make it shelf stable, where I could just have it and use it and give it away.
Mm-hmm. And how do you describe ghee for any listeners who aren't that familiar with ghee as a product?
Ghee is basically clarified butter, but it's clarified to a point where we're actually cooking the milk solids. So the oil and the milk solids separate, and you want to kind of toast those milk solids, and it gives it this beautiful nutty flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until very recently that I learned that you can make brown butter ghee, which I had made by accident at one point, where you basically just
happy accident
burn it. I cooked it. This ghee in particular is like 36 hours cooked.
Wow.
But it tastes like sugar cookie without the sugar. It's
like
the best.
Oh, I can't wait to try it.
Yeah.
So in this R&D time, David, did you consume a lot of different butters and ghee?
Yeah, I'm from the Midwest, so making biscuits was kind of a daily thing growing up.
Love that.
Yeah, so I mean, the more she could make, the more I could cook my favorite little comfort foods.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
So to jump to the other topic that we kind of talked about right at the break, I'm really curious to hear more about your employees and how you're harnessing that energy that you mentioned. You know, David, you mentioned that was one of the biggest surprises that you've found, a really delightful surprise, it sounds like, in that your staff has brought a lot to the table as you've gotten up and running. Sure. So would you say, you know, what would you say is your approach as, I mean, it sounds like you're on site. I take it you're both sort of managing all operations, including staff, which can be a real challenge. And how do you approach that part of the work?
Well, I think that Tamara's handling a lot of the HR portions of the business. So she's seeing the kind of like the first impressions coming through the door, and having done so much of it at the farm and dealing with so many people that are passionate about food and agriculture, she's seeing a lot of that come through with the employees that are coming. It doesn't hurt also that we're paying a living wage and we're giving health insurance to our employees.
Wow.
So we're trying to be responsible employers at the same time. And with that comes people that kind of have an advanced understanding of, you know, what's important to them, like a place that they want to feel like they're amongst other people with those sort of ethics and moral standings. And
so it's sort of a self-selecting group in that way.
It is. And with that have come people that have like already had a lot of education and background related to food. We have a baker that just moved back from Istanbul, and she was doing pastry school out there, and she's brought all these amazing things like simit, which is a bagel from Turkey.
Simit, that's simit. The potato bagel?
No, that's totally different. It's like different. A bagel that's kind of been extended twice as long and twisted together and put in sesame. They use a different sort of bath, which is a grape molasses. It's a really beautiful food product, and they put those nice cheeses that they have over there, those white cheeses. It's really incredible.
Wow. But,
I think giving people the creative freedom too. We have all this wonderful equipment, and this like it's exposed. It's basically a factory inside out, and we have this cool stuff that we want people to experiment with and bring their creativity to. We're making cotija right now in the creamery, just because Ashton, who I work with in the creamery, has always like wanted to learn how to make it. So like that's her passion right now. So
that
she's working
so cool.
on that. Yeah.
Was that part of your goal setting out, which was like to just sort of innovate constantly, to have sort of an R&D approach to the production capabilities of the space?
Exactly. I mean, aside from the standards that we're trying to give to people, because, you know, San Francisco's sort of a bagel desert, so we wanted to offer those sort of standards to people to get them back into getting those things. We have a lot of transplants, and I can't tell you how many times I hear people from Jersey, New York, Philadelphia.
I've never had a good bagel finally, in San Francisco. Not yet.
But also that sort of creative spirit. I'm an art schooler, and so bringing that creative spirit to food products, we want everyone to feel like they can bring their expertise and their history to the thing, to the project too. So we have said to people from the start, if you have something you want to try, if you have something you want to do, let's figure out how to market it. Let's make it. Let's see what everybody thinks and try it out.
A lot of that stems too from the farm, which is kind of like a sister project or sister affiliation.
Right.
And at the farm, it's always like exciting for people to try new things. And you want to try this new cheese, or you want to try planting this, or Tamara and David have always been like cultivating that creative energy, which is
so
great too.
At Tuluma Farms, and would you say also Tamales Farmstead Creamery?
Same, yeah.
The ethos is shared.
Yes,
this is
absolutely
been consistent
and cross pollination in that regard. Like we want people to go, you want to see where the milk is actually coming from? Come with me. Like let's go take a look and see.
Right, like your retail staff in the cafe have this opportunity to go up and see what's going on, sort of firsthand.
Encouraged, yeah, yeah.
So I want to ask you a little bit about living wage and health insurance. This is something we talk about a lot on air. I wish we talked about it even more. It feels, you know, here in New York, the small business owners I talk to, you know, this is like a long-term goal. It's rarely something, sadly, that I feel like businesses sort of build into the initial plan. So how are you pulling that off? Was that something you planned for from day zero and built around, or what's
it was definitely what's a hope from the conception. Our cost of goods is extremely high because we're organic certified, we're using the best quality milk, the best quality flour across the board. So because of that, in turn, we have to charge a real price for the product that we sell.
Right.
And you know, we want to include that when we have so much pride in our product, whenever pride in our staff as well. And so it's just hand in hand. I mean, we feel like we're making a responsible product, and we have to be responsible employers. So, yeah.
Is this something that you broadcast to your customers in a visible way? How do you handle sort of that piece, especially when it comes to pricing? If people are like, you've got someone from New York who's used to a bagel that costs $2.75 or maybe even $1.75, and they're like, what is this?
Every day.
Yeah, I mean, we've had to have some, we had kickback, of course, with the pricing. And Tamara's been doing our social media, and she's been very good about saying, like, where this is real food with real people making it, real people that live in a city that's very expensive. And we care about our food and we care about our people. And this is
the true cost of it.
I think the real cost. You know, there's no gouging happening here. It's like,
tricky. It's like that the perception of food cost is so disparate from the reality.
Absolutely. Right.
So
we're extremely fortunate too, though, to have a customer base that appreciates not only the quality of the food, but the quality of the staff. And they understand the model. I mean, it's not without having to educate some people, but it's definitely been appreciated.
Got it. Now, in terms of the space that you're in, I'm also sort of vaguely aware that there's some special, you're in something called the American Industrial Center, is that right? Mm-hmm. And is that, you know, when I was researching before the show and kind of exploring like where you are and what that space is, it sounds like that's a unique, almost sounded like an incubator, but tell me a little bit about how that space operates and how it helps, has helped you to build this business.
Sure. So the American Industrial Center used to be the American Can Company. It's one of the only two, it's 1 million square feet. It's two buildings occupying basically four city blocks, two blocks and two blocks with the road dividing the two.
And this is in San Francisco proper.
In San Francisco. Yeah. On a industrial corridor heading south out of town.
Okay.
Not even a half a mile from downtown, but they're the only two buildings that are zoned innovative industries. And that's special because you can produce something on an industrial level but still retain 15% ancillary retail component. So you can have people in and you can serve them food. You can have, you know, if you're a clothing maker or whatnot, we have gyms, museums, all kinds of different things. You can still have that interaction while producing at a larger scale. And with us being 7,000 square feet, it's obvious, you know, we're going to produce a lot of product, but we want to get people in there and have that immersive experience. So it's a really amazing space for that reason.
So it sounds like there's a real community happening just even within these two buildings.
Absolutely. Yes.
And how long has that been in existence?
Ooh, for a long time. I think the current owners bought it in the 70s.
Wow.
It's only been in the last, I want to say, 10 years that they've started to open it up to makers to come in and start new businesses. So we have everything from chocolatiers to granola makers to other bakeries.
Those, yeah.
Yeah, restaurants. Amazing, just all kinds of amazing things.
Wow. Especially in a city with, you know, rent costs rivaling or even eclipsing New York, I think that seems really important. Is the cost of your space sort of more reasonable in any way, or is it mostly just that you can do both things in one space, so you get more value
out of?
It's more reasonable. Yeah, it's also more reasonable. Wow, that's so great.
Yeah, it is. Wow, a big draw.
I'm so happy for you. And I need to book my ticket to San Francisco immediately.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I'd love to have you.
Okay, wow. Well, as we get to the end of our episode, I have two final questions. One is kind of, you know, geeky. I'm a real, like, organizing tech geek, and also maybe non-tech. I went through a bullet journal phase. But I'm always interested in asking people who have done, you know, incredible things, who've pulled things off, like what you're doing with Daily Driver. Are there any systems or tools or processes, anything from an app that you love that has helped you in this time of craziness, or, you know, a ritual or something that you do that you feel like grounds you and has helped keep things sane?
I'll let you answer that, considering I have just a file folder full of crumbled papers.
I love that. Yeah. Well, you know what? That's also important to hear, too.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think it's important to know that you don't have to be so, like, crazy in order to pull stuff
Definitely up. Not. I think we all have our own personal systems.
Yeah, exactly.
But we Slack constantly. I mean, Slack. That's how we all communicate with each other.
And is that your whole staff's in on Slack, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
We Slack constantly, and we utilize Google. I mean, Google Drive and all
the G Suite stuff.
The G Suite stuff is,
So all your documentation. all of that, all of your analysis is happening there.
Mm-hmm. I still print and write things out.
Right.
I'm the worst out of our whole crew.
You know what? It's important okay, to have somebody who is not just looking at everything through a screen. I really think it is important. I love that. And my next question is, how many bagels do you eat a week?
Oh, gosh.
Ooh.
How many days are we open?
14?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot. I think our three-year-old eats more than we do.
Yeah. Well, she eats halves.
So. She eats halves.
Just the top half.
She wants a bagel, no seeds, extra cream cheese.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. A kid who knows what she likes.
All she cares about.
Is there a family preference between bagel toppings?
Oh, you'd have a preference. Oh, that's more of your tomato, avocado, cream cheese.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm always a salt bagel with tomato, avocado, and cream cheese. But that was even before I was baking. I mean, that's kind of my standard. That's how
forever.
That's my litmus test for a bagel shop.
Wow.
Yeah. But I'm also like a pumpernickel fan.
Me too.
The Barney Greengrass kind of
pump deal. Is my number one.
Yeah,
right?
So good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it changes all the time. I think that I was like, I loved everything when we started. Now it's kind of my least favorite, and I'm more on the pumpernickel rye side. So, but it's nice to have that many options so you can move
totally.
Around and try different things.
Totally. Yeah. Changes. It's like Hadley's focusing on how the butter changes with the right. season. David's like, this is my sesame season.
Exactly.
I think this is a good, this is really a nice match. Oh, great. Well, Hadley, David, thank you both so much for joining me on air today.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed this week's show. For those of you in the Bay Area or anyone traveling there, we'd love to see your photos of Daily Driver. Tag us on Twitter and Instagram at CuttingTheCurd or shoot us an email with your photos at CuttingTheCurd@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with more Cutting the Curd. Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.